From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On this week's show, a conflict between the Vatican and some American nuns divides area Catholics.
I'm just appalled that the Vatican would even go after them. They need to clean their own house.
Kansas City has a unique take on poetry slams, and a local man's neighborhood fireworks display goes very, very wrong.
People that were on my driveway were diving for cover. My older brother was sitting closest to the display with his wife. He threw her on the ground and threw his body on top of her.
Plus, this week will mark the first happy hours in Kansas in more than 25 years.
I don't see it like becoming like a crazy, like, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah, everyone's drunk at 3 in the afternoon or anything like that, you know?
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We take you to neighborhoods around the region using voices, stories, and sound.
Last week's Supreme Court ruling upholding the federal health law has provided more clarity to the future of health care in the U.S. and in this region. But as key parts of the law now move to the states to implement, uncertainty, largely due to politics, surrounds how states will enact those measures. KCUR's Alana Gordon reports.
Kansas Insurance Commissioner Sandy Prager summed up the nearly 200-page Supreme Court ruling like this.
Public policy in this country now is that all people will have access to health care services and a means to pay for it.
But it's more complicated than that. And a lot lies at the state level in preparing for the next big wave of the law's provisions, which take effect in 2014. One of the biggest things is how states set up a health exchange. That's the online marketplace where individuals and small businesses will go to compare and shop for health policies. The state could run it, or the federal government, or there could be some sort of partnership. Prager says the state's done a lot of background work, but that still might not be enough.
I think it's too late for us to be a state-based exchange because we needed legislation this session that gave us the go-ahead and created the governance structure.
Political opposition and uncertainty over the law have kept Kansas, Missouri, and other states from moving forward in developing an exchange. Kansas Governor Sam Brownback returned a federal exchange grant last year. Following the Supreme Court ruling, Brownback's office said they wouldn't take any action to implement the law. Missouri State Senator Scott Roop, a Republican who headed an interim committee looking into exchanges, says he doesn't anticipate Missouri having anything to do with one.
By not creating the exchange, you're just simply putting that back on the federal government and saying, you know, we want the free market system in our state. Go ahead and create an exchange and do what you want, but we're not going to pay for it with Missouri tax dollars.
David Gentile, president of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Kansas City, says the Supreme Court's ruling affirmed the work the insurance company's already been doing with regards to the law. But he says he's looking forward to more direction with the health exchanges.
The difficulty with the federal exchange process is that we don't really know what the rules are. The regulations haven't been published yet, and there's a lot of uncertainty about how that will actually come down from Washington in terms of how it impacts the individuals, how it impacts employers, how it impacts the insurance carriers, or how it impacts the states.
Aside from what the exchanges look like and who runs them, there are other unknowns relating to health coverage in Kansas and Missouri. Ryan Barker is with the Missouri Foundation for Health.
So in general, the ruling gives us quite a bit of clarity on almost all aspects of the Affordable Care Act. The little question, I guess, which is sort of a big question, is around this Medicaid expansion.
The Affordable Care Act expands Medicaid eligibility, but the Supreme Court's ruling makes that expansion voluntary for states. If states do participate in it, the federal government would fully pay for the expansion for the first 3 years. Then states would pay about 10% of it. Barker says in Missouri, the decision would affect between 250 and 300,000 residents who don't have insurance. U.S. Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri says expanding the program would still be too big of a burden.
States are already struggling to pay their current Medicaid cost. Education funding is going down in many states every year, including ours, for the last 3 years.
There's also uncertainty in Kansas. The Kansas Health Institute estimates about 130,000 residents would be affected by an expansion. Barb Langner is with KU Med Center and used to oversee the state's Medicaid program.
Kansas was one of the states that filed in the lawsuit, and one of the things that they were concerned about was the cost of the Medicaid program with the expansion. And so I think there will be continued resistance or concern about adding another third to the current Medicaid program.
The situation creates another level of uncertainty for people who make little or no money and don't qualify for Medicaid under current guidelines. For now, they fall into this kind of hole where they don't make enough under the law to qualify for subsidies to buy insurance. Kansas Insurance Commissioner Sandy Prager says between that and figuring out how exchanges will run, a lot of work lies ahead.
It's going to be a heavy lift, and we're just going to keep our head down and keep focused.
But with many unknowns still out there with the law, she and others will be looking to see how this plays out in Topeka and Jefferson City over the next few years. Alana Gordon, KCUR News.
Back in mid-April, the Vatican issued strong criticism of its largest organization of American Catholic nuns, the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. The Vatican announced the organization would need to undergo some major changes, and these would be overseen by the Archbishop of Seattle. The action prompted protests and vigils across the country to support the nuns. Alex Smith looked into how the debate is affecting Catholics in Kansas City.
On a recent Tuesday evening, around 250 people crowded into the southern end of Mill Creek Park next to the plaza. Wearing mostly white, they sang and cheered and carried signs urging passersby to support the nuns.
I'm Molly Stevie. I'm here this afternoon because I have been close to many sisters in two or three different orders, and I'm well aware of the 24/7 commitment that these women put in. And their leaders are very intelligent and very educated and very capable of running their own communities. And I feel that they have not received the respect and the support they should receive from the Vatican and the hierarchy of the Church.
I'm Dan Dakotas. I just want to support the nuns. They have been a huge part of my spirituality in all my life. And I work with them in the prison, and I think they're wonderful. I work with the homeless with them, and I'm just appalled that the Vatican would even go after them. They need to clean their own house. Shame on them.
My name's Liz Claus, just like Santa. I've been a cradle Catholic all my life, and the women are basically the force behind the church, and to come down hard on the nuns, who are the people who really practice the gospel. They feed the poor, they heal the sick, they teach the schools, they run the daycares, they run the soup kitchens. So it's not the priests who are out doing this, or the pope, or the bishop. It's the nuns. So, I mean, I'm just not going back 200 years. So if they're going back there, I'm done with them.
I'm Sister Jean Christensen. I'm a Sister of Mercy. And we understand people's desire to show us support, so we wanted to come and be present with them. I also find it extremely hopeful to see this many people out here saying to us, we support you, we believe in what you're doing.
Thank you. Now, it's about the sisters. Have you heard about the Vatican investigating the sisters?
The Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith says they launched their investigation of the LCRW after concerns that some of the speakers at their events and books they used were incompatible with teachings of the Church. They accused the leadership of dissenting with the Church and claimed that some of the LCRW's programs promoted radical feminism. Catholic reporter Joshua McElwee explains that the Vatican was not only bothered by what the LCRW was teaching, but also by what it wasn't teaching.
Part of the assessment said that they weren't speaking clearly enough or loudly enough about official Church teaching on issues like homosexuality abortion and gay marriage and those types of things. And it wasn't so much that the sisters were saying anything against the Church or against official teaching, but that the Vatican thought they weren't speaking loud enough in favor of.
Joshua McElwee has been covering the issue for the National Catholic Reporter, which is based in Kansas City. While the assessment has inspired plenty of vocal critics, other Catholics are reluctant to talk publicly about the issue. torn between loyalty for local nuns and the Vatican. But McElwee says confusion and anger over the assessment is pretty widespread.
Catholic sisters are really seen as the face of the church in some ways. And for a lot of people, there's just confusion about why the Vatican would take this move and what it means about the work of so many sisters who have really dedicated their lives to things that are very honorable and to the service of people in general.
The recent event at Mill Creek Park called Support the Sisters was organized primarily by Janelle Lazo. She's the local spokesperson for Call to Action, a national organization pushing for issues like the ordination of women and a change in the church's position on gays and lesbians. Like many at the vigil, Lazo believes the Vatican's assessment and prescribed actions are an attack on nuns.
To me, it's bullying. To tell sisters that they haven't said enough to support something that somebody else thinks they should, I think that's bullying.
According to Vatican supporters, a lot of the protesters miss the point of what's really a narrowly focused action. Jude Hunts is chancellor of the Kansas City St. Joseph Diocese, which contains 236 nuns. He says the assessment is only a critique of some leaders in the LCRW.
The Vatican letter made it clear that there were only some very narrow groups of sisters within that larger group that they had issue with and were not taking the entire group to task for the sins of the few.
For a lot of Catholics, a statement from the Vatican means an issue is settled. The Catholic Church has a strict hierarchy, and its leaders teach one interpretation of the scriptures. But others say this isn't the case. In the early 60s, Pope John XXIII started a second Vatican Council, sometimes called Vatican II. 4 years of meetings and discussions led to some major liberalization of church practices. Janelle Lazo says that the Vatican II era, which lasted about 10 years, was an exciting time to be Catholic.
When the Second Vatican Council came about, it was just exciting to me. It was just, I felt like I was church. And I just gravitated to it because I was able to preach then. I was able to organize a Sunday preschool. I was able to, you know, bond with people my age and discuss all the issues, and I was just excited.
One of the big ideas that gained popularity during this era was census fidelium, or sense of the faithful. Lazo says that, according to this teaching, nuns aren't obligated to teach doctrine they don't agree with.
No pope is above that. If people are following their consciences, even our canon law says, we have primacy of conscience. And you can tell me what to do, but if I don't think it's right, I shouldn't do it. And that was totally what Jesus taught. He was always bucking authority that he did not think was right.
Census fidelium continues to be a controversial topic among Catholics. Jude Hunts believes the concept is often misinterpreted.
Well, I think the sense of the faithful has always been understood by some to mean some sort of a democratic understanding of the faith right now. But it actually is a much deeper and richer term that means not just what we believe now, but what we've always believed as a faith tradition going back 2,000 years. So in determining what the census fidelium is, or what the sense of the faithful is, we look not just to what we're saying today or what some people as a group might hold today, but we have to check that against what has always been held by our church as a tradition.
Because the Leadership Conference of Women Religious was created by and answers to the Vatican, the group can't accept or reject the assessment. But Joshua McElwee says the group is considering other options.
What some sisters have said could be an option is if they don't want to go forward with this mandate or go forward with the order, they could, you know, fold the group as it is, let go of the church's official representation, and kind of form as a nonprofit group outside official church structures. But at this point, it's not very clear if that's something they're really considering or if that might be too far.
In mid-June, the Leadership Conference of Women Religious sent a couple of its leaders to meet with Vatican officials, but they described their initial meetings as difficult. The Vatican is now on a summer vacation, so any future developments probably won't take place until the fall. For Casey Currents, this is Alex Smith.
Coming up, what became of a Kansas City man's obsession with fireworks? You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Last week on the show, we interviewed a man with an idea to provide free and low-cost wireless internet to residents of the Rosedale neighborhood in Kansas City, Kansas. Michael Limata of the organization Connecting for Good says he wants to help eliminate the digital divide in the Kansas City area between people who are connected to the internet and those who can't afford it. Limata wanted to build the Wi-Fi network on top of the coming Google fiber optic network, which promises gigabit internet speeds. Well, on Tuesday, he heard from Google that they weren't going to let that happen. He says Google officials told him the project would conflict with their current licensing agreements. Limata says he may pursue the idea with other area internet providers and still wants to develop his other idea of building an e-community center in Rosedale.
Kansas wheat farmers may be tied to the land, but their crop isn't. About half of the wheat grown in the United States each year is exported. To help sustain these markets, the wheat industry invites these overseas customers to come to the U.S. to see how the wheat they buy gets from farm to the port. Harvest Public Media's Camille Phillips joined a group from Nigeria for a portion of one such tour, a visit to the Kansas City Board of Trade.
Behind them in the navy jackets with the green collar is ADM Investor Services. That was the opening bell.
Oh, my God.
It's 9:30 a.m. and the wheat market at the Kansas City Board of Trade opens with little fanfare. Seven Nigerian men look down from the balcony into the pit, watching traders swap papers and peer onto laptops. Deborah Bowman, the board's assistant vice president of marketing, describes the activity below.
But you see there's a few people that are standing here in the pit. You have the gentleman that's in the black jacket as a broker.
These days, Bowman explains, most trading takes place electronically. An electronic market has been open since 5 p.m. yesterday. Still, it's likely that the wheat price being decided on in the pit right now will impact the bottom line for the flour mills the Nigerian men represent. Nigeria is one of the top three importers of American wheat. On the surface, a flour mill in Nigeria doesn't make much sense. After all, the climate is not conducive to growing wheat. But Nigerian flour mills are successful, Muyiwa Talabi says, because Nigerians love bread. Talabi works for the U.S. wheat industry in Lagos, Nigeria.
The British colonized Nigeria, and bread was one of the staple for the British. And Nigerians picked that attitude of eating bread.
Talabi says that there are 22 commercial milling companies in Nigeria. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, last year Nigeria imported more than 3.7 million tons of American wheat. Only Japan and Mexico bought more. U.S. Wheat Associates is the industry organization that sponsors the Nigerian tour and about nine others each year. It represents the international trade interests of 19 state wheat commissions. It is funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and wheat farmers through a checkoff paid to those state commissions. Trade visits such as this are a vital part of keeping the wheat export business successful, says Aaron Harries, Director of Marketing for the Kansas Wheat Commission.
It's reassuring to them to come and see where the product is coming from, seeing individuals face-to-face. And relationships are very important to them. Some buyers of wheat are what we call price buyers, where they ultimately buy the cheapest wheat available. Nigerians don't do that.
This particular tour through three states was to last 10 days and take the Nigerians to research labs, shipping yards, and grain elevators. Before arriving at the Kansas City Board of Trade, the Nigerians had already visited farmers in Nebraska and Kansas. That was a highlight for Tunde Adebayo, Human Resource Manager at Honeywell Flour PLC.
I had the opportunity to see the wheat farmers, to see the wheat being harvested, and also look at the quality check that goes on to ensure that the quality of the wheat that gets to us, even in Nigeria, is the right quality.
Babatunde Adawu, Division Head for Flour Mills of Nigeria, says the technology and skills he witnessed on this trip encourages him to dream of a future where his own country has a stronger agricultural presence.
So I appreciate what they do. I wish we could do the same thing back home.
Wish you could do the same thing back home?
Back home, yeah. That is, produce at least where we have advantage, like rice, maize, mm-hmm. so that we can also be like the U.S. We can also feed the world with our maize, rice, and sugar.
That doesn't mean the U.S. wheat industry needs to worry.
But will you continue to buy U.S. wheat?
Of course we would. No doubt about that.
The Kansas Wheat Commission is hosting a Colombian team in July. It's in honor of the new Colombia-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. If the trade agreement had not been reached, U.S. Wheat Associates estimates up to $100 million annually in wheat sales could have been lost to Canada. That's because Canada reached a trade agreement with Colombia several months earlier than the U.S. did. I'm Camille Phillips for Harvest Public Media.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Kearns today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
The 4th of July is this week, and we all know Kansas Cityans are into fireworks. You can watch big displays at Berkeley Riverfront Park, Worlds of Fun, Shawnee Mission Park, pretty much any direction on the compass. But a lot of people prefer to do it themselves, and fireworks enthusiasts compete to see who can put on the best show. But as one local attorney found out, the desire to impress your neighbors can have explosive consequences. And even a criminal defense lawyer can find himself on the other side of the law.
I'm John Humphrey. Grew up in the south part of town in Redbridge Subdivision, which was brand new when we moved in 63 or 4. We had the distinction of living across the street from Lenny Dawson, who was quarterback for the Chiefs at the time. Also into our neighborhood moved this Bobby Yarborough, who was the equipment manager for the Chiefs, and he kind of changed the dynamic of the summer 4th of July holiday. He had big block parties, and at the end of the 4th of July parties every summer, he'd set off a gazillion black cats. I mean, it just seemed to go on and on. My folks never let us get black cats. We get smoke bombs, snakes, things that weren't inherently dangerous. So, as I always tell my son, best thing about being an adult is you've got an income. You can get all the stuff you always wanted to get as a kid but didn't have the money. Well, the second place we lived when I was married was in South Kansas City. You know, when we were still the one house on the west side of the street, I would go buy just the consumer fireworks that were available at the tents, and the neighbors that were there, you know, they'd all come out and watch, and we had little kid parades, you know, in the battery-operated Barbie cars. You know, a couple of neighbor kids would process down the street to John Philip Sousa's Stars and Stripes. And then I'd set off, you know, these parachutes and skyrockets. The neighbors loved it. Oh, they looked forward to it every year. You know, they'd always say, are you going to put on your fireworks? Yes, yes. Oh, wait till you see this year. My wife would cook out, so my family would all come over. When the fireworks started getting bigger and bigger, my mom said, okay, I'm leaving now if the fireworks are starting. So there were some detractors. And then I got an inside contact who could get M80s, which are, of course, illegal. The first year I got M80s, I got, I don't know, maybe a dozen. And within the next couple of years, I was buying them by the gross. It's kind of like a 60-year-old man buying a Corvette. It's just the epitome of all power. It is so loud, the concussion is tremendous, and they are so, so dangerous. There was one guy who lived down the street and around the corner. He, at the time, was probably close to 70. He came down one night. It was well past the 4th of July, but I would walk around the neighborhood and willy-nilly just light him and throw him in the sewers, fuck, boom, boom, boom. Walk around with a plumbing blowtorch, psh, psh, and he said, what are you doing lighting off those fireworks? I guess you know those are illegal. I said, well, nobody else is complaining. And he replied that, well, all the other neighbors are afraid of you. And I said, like a jerk, as it should be. By 2003, I had started getting the big commercial fireworks that, like you see at Royal Stadium when the home runs go off. I had sense enough that year to use caution tape to tape off the backyard. My wife had found out how much I spent on the fireworks for 2003, and she was mad. She was really mad, and she said, if you're spending that kind of money, we're not even talking about this. That's it. I'm not even going to be here. I'm not cooking out for your family. I'm leaving. Sure enough, July 4th afternoon, around 4 or 5, my wife left the house. So when everybody gathered at my house and all the neighbors had gathered and been sufficiently lubricated with drink, and when it got almost completely dark, I started the show and 10 of the mortars went up, and these were designed just for the explosion. And, oh, it's a wonderful, wonderful feeling. As soon as they went off, I could see the embers from their fuses drifting to the ground over the rest of the display. And almost immediately after that, hell broke out. The mortars on the ground started discharging in every direction. I mean, it's still terrifying to think about. It took a half a second before people realized, uh-oh, something really went wrong. And this was the first year there had ever been any incident. And so people that were on my driveway, I still had it taped off, were diving for cover. My older brother was sitting closest to the display with his wife. He threw her on the ground and threw his body on top of her. My mother-in-law was there with her significant other. You know, they were elderly. They couldn't really scramble as fast as other people. But by the grace of God, nobody got hit that time. There was a brief lull in the madness, and we started walking up towards these mortars, some of which were still standing, and a second volley launched. And everybody just ran as far as they could and let it burn itself out. It seemed like forever, but, you know, it was probably no more than a few seconds. These huge explosions weren't happening 300 feet in the air. They're happening at ground level and whizzing by. So when the second volley of unintended explosions had died off, my younger brother had a hose that we had prepared just for this instance, and he started filling the tubes up from a safe distance with arcs of water, and it was just dead silent. I mean, the whole neighborhood was dead silent, and there was the creepy smoke just kind of wafting past. You know, it's no air. It was really hot like it is today. And I just started running around screaming, is anybody hurt? Is everybody okay? And everybody was okay. The only person who got hit with anything, miraculously, was my oldest niece, who was 150 feet across the street. And she got hit with part of a shell in the knee. It didn't break her skin. It just stung. But as a matter of precaution, my sister took her to the emergency room. My sister did not know at the time she took her to the emergency room that any injury resulting from these illegal fireworks triggered this newly enacted provision of the anti-terrorism bill, the domestic explosives provision, such that if you have illegal fireworks and there's any physical injury, you can be prosecuted under federal law. And it had just taken effect within the 30 days preceding this 4th of July. Looking around, I saw my patio umbrella shredded like a Civil War flag. And some young kid says, dude, there's a hole in your house. And I looked at the back of my house, just past this umbrella. There was, in fact, a hole about a yard in diameter in the back of my kitchen. And there was smoke just coming out. And I thought, oh, my God, my kids are in there. So I ran inside, and there was smoke hugging the ceiling, but my son was right there on the couch, asleep like he had been. My oldest sister had, at that point, burst through the front door. She grabbed my son and said, I've got Maddie from upstairs. I've got your kids. We're going. And I, great. I mean, that was one thing I didn't have to deal with. The kitchen was destroyed, absolutely destroyed. When the mortar hit the back of the house, it hit a stud, pulverized it. It blew the cabinets off the wall. All the dishes that were in there were strewn across the hardwood floors in pieces. If anybody had been in the house, they would have been instantly killed. I repeat, the luckiest man on the face of the earth. I mean, consider this guy up north who was firing a handgun off last 4th of July or two ago into the lake. It ricocheted and killed a girl. That something like that didn't happen to me is only grace. I cursed. I went back outside. And about that time, this old man from the year before, who had complained to me about my M80s and to whom I'd been such a smart aleck, he and his son were coming up the driveway. And his son is wagging a finger saying, "You caught my roof on fire! You caught my roof on fire!" Now, I didn't believe it because he lived so far away. But the fact was, he was watching from his second-story window my fireworks display, and one of the mortars shot horizontally and hit right underneath his roof and started a flame. After they got that flame put out, they called the police and the fire department. So right after the man and his son came up yelling at me, a guy in uniform, policeman, came walking into the backyard. I could hear the sirens, you know, and I was like, oh, this is not good. The policeman came up and said, "I assume you've got a permit for this, just being a smart aleck." And I said, "You know, I got a lot of stuff to deal with here. Write me a ticket and leave me alone." In my mind, the only thing I could possibly be guilty of, besides total stupidity and inconsideration, was a city ordinance violation. And so I immediately apologized to him and said, "Look, I'm sorry to be a jerk, but I got to deal with this." And he just kind of nodded and he said, "All right, wait right here." Pretty soon he came back with his sergeant. And they were talking to me, wanting to know from whence these fireworks had come. And I said, "I don't want to get into that." I said, "Listen, I got to go to the bathroom." He's like, "No, you're in custody." I'm like, "I'm in custody. I'm on my own swing set." He's like, "Yeah, but you're in custody. You're going to stay right here." They eventually handcuffed me and did the perp walk down my driveway to the waiting paddy wagon. So while I'm sitting on the paddy wagon, my folks show up. Now, I'm 42 or 3 years old. And if you think you ever outgrow your parents' look of disdain, you never do. My dad looked over at me, and it was just, oh, you know how parents are. They don't have to say anything. They just give you that look, and I just melted in a puddle of shame. I signed the consent to search. Everything they were looking for was in the garage. So they saw all these different, like, exotic-looking ignition devices coupled with the mortars and decided maybe the feds wanted to take a look at this. And they finally decided they were just going to take me downtown. And as they drove me north on Highway 71, all I could do was drink in the ice-cold air. I even criticized, still being a smart aleck to the end, they were listening to some really bad music, and I said something to that effect. Stone-faced, the police officers. But I was drinking in the cold air, knowing from my clients what it's like to spend a night in the Kansas City jail. And it's hideous. And I knew I wouldn't sleep. I knew I wouldn't go to the bathroom down there if it was anything like my clients had told me. And right about 22nd Street, they got off the highway and turned around and started heading back south. And I asked the officers, I'm like, "Okay, so what happened?" They said, "We just got radioed to take you back." When I pulled up into my driveway, there was a lady with blonde short hair in plain clothes standing there next to her unmarked police car. She introduced herself as the Kansas City bomb and arson detective. And she said that based on what they had found in the consent to search, they contacted the Federal Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau. And the ATF said to her they wanted jurisdiction on the case. The feds wanted this case. And I didn't realize at the time it was because, oh, the new Domestic Explosives Act has taken effect. When I got home that night from the police station, the guy that helps me buy these was at the house. And then my wife's car pulls in the driveway. My friend, who's 5 or 6 years older than I am, he was shaking like a little kid. He's like, oh, God, what are you going to do? What? Oh, what's she going to say? I'm like, shut up. Truth of the matter was, I was scared to death. So she gets out of the car, and we just stand there, my friend and I, quietly. She says to us, there's really nothing I can say to you two that's going to make the point I was trying to any better than what actually happened. Then she walked into the garage where our stack of 160,000 black cats had been. And she says, they took the black cats. I knew that I would not be divorced at that point. 2 days later, I was home late afternoon, sleeping, taking a nap. My wife came up and said, wake up, wake up. There's two ATF agents at the door. I'm calling John O'Connor, very well-known criminal defense attorney, friend of mine. Well, sure enough, they had intended to file federal criminal charges. The bottom line was they wanted to know where I got these explosives. I told my wife, I'm like, I'm not going to tell them. I mean, I've been getting stuff from this guy for a long time. And we kind of had an understanding. I was giving him a lot of cash, and he was giving me cool stuff. And I probably wasn't the only one that was he was doing this with. And if word got out, I mean, literally, he had threatened to kill me, you know, kind of half jokingly in one of these transactions. But I knew that it was big trouble for us. And she said, you know what? I know where you got him, and I'll tell him. I am not going to visit your ass in Leavenworth with three little kids. And eventually she did. She convinced me that if I wanted to avoid this prosecution, I had to cooperate, just like I had advised my clients on so many occasions before. And the horrible part of it was that this guy who'd been so nice to me, there was a federal criminal prosecution, and he was put on trial. It was a week-long jury trial. The jury basically heard, okay, wait a minute. This idiot blew up his own house, plus two neighbors. His insurance paid for all of it. Why are we here? And they found the guy not guilty. So he was acquitted, but he was still mad. After the prosecution had ended, the ATF agent advised me that they would be keeping an eye on me. So we don't have snakes at my house. We don't have sparklers. We no longer celebrate the 4th of July in traditional style. The 4th of July, I stay inside, and I listen to the amateurs in the neighborhood lighting off their little consumer fireworks. You know, there are other things that are far more important to me than being the guy with the biggest explosives. I mean, I still put on the coolest Halloween in the world, but it's not really illegal. And that's a true fact. You can ask my neighbors.
John Humphrey is a criminal defense attorney in Kansas City. His story was produced by Casey Kearns intern Zach Lewandowski and me. And by the way, the firework sounds you hear in this piece were just illustrations, not from the actual event. For a link to firework safety laws in the Kansas City area, check our website, kcur.org.
After the break, happy hours return to Kansas. This is Casey Kearns.
This is Casey Kearns. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, Kansas City, Missouri got ready to spend more on development incentives and less on Kemper Arena. The Supreme Court healthcare decision elated some, enraged others, but didn't immediately change anything in Missouri and Kansas. Steve Bell revisits those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
Most Democrats praised the Supreme Court's health care ruling. Most Republicans condemned it. Missouri Democrats Jay Nixon and Claire McCaskill tried to sit on the fence. And some Kansas moderate Republicans, like Insurance Commissioner Sandy Prager, said it was a proud day for the country.
I'm proud of our country today that we've made that kind of a statement about what our country ought to be doing for everyone.
Governor Sam Brownback was not so proud, nor were the conservative Republicans in both the Kansas and Missouri legislatures. Their strategy, don't expand Medicaid or implement other portions of the law, stall till after the election in hopes Republicans will win big and repeal it. That frustrated Dr. Ed Weisbart of Missouri Physicians for a National Health Program.
We're going to have 260,000 people across our state who will remain uninsured despite the fact that the federal government is standing armed, ready, and willing to pay for it.
Also up in the air is whether to create the online health exchanges. The Supreme Court partly accepted and partly rejected an Arizona immigration law Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach helped write. Kobach called it a victory, but the ACLU's Gary Brunk said Kansas and Missouri should think twice before passing any similar law.
I think that this should be great caution on the part of states to move forward on copycat laws like this.
The court rejected the part of the law requiring all immigrants to carry registration papers, but said instructing state law enforcers to check the immigration status of persons stopped for other reasons was allowable, depending on how it's enforced. The Kansas City City Council took back the management of Kemper Arena, relieving Anschutz Entertainment of the responsibility for two competing arenas. Finance Chair Jan Markison explained.
We'll move forward making sure Kemper's available for American Royal activities, but not throwing good money after bad on certain things and trying to minimize our costs.
The council also approved millions in incentives for two projects, a 23-story apartment tower in the Power and Light District and a corporate headquarters at 435 and State Line for Freightquote. Mayor Sly James said that one, which lured Freightquote from Overland Park, helps Kansas City, Missouri, and makes a statement to Kansas.
It could be the catalyst for conversations between the city of Kansas City, Missouri, and the state of Kansas to cool down this bi-state transfer of business assets at a high price.
Both projects involve millions in subsidies and tax abatement up to 100%, part of which will last for around 25 years. Neighbors were shocked when police found a child had been kept a prisoner in a squalid Midtown Kansas City closet. Jacole Prince, mother of the 32-pound 10-year-old, was jailed on multiple charges. Senator Pat Roberts gave advance word that the KU Med Center will be designated a research center by the National Cancer Institute. Cancer Center Director Roy Jensen said KU has been working on that a long time.
This institution submitted an application in the mid-1970s.
The formal announcement should come within a month or two. Wrapping up the week, a court ordered the Kansas City St. Joseph Catholic Diocese to turn over its documentation of its investigation of sexual misconduct by priests to prosecutors. And the weather was very hot, and still is, and will be through the coming week. This is KCUR.
It's a toast to the happy hour, so raise your glasses, Kansans. As of July 1st, Kansans are legally able to partake in the after-work and late-night tradition of happy hour drink specials. Since 1985, it's been illegal for area bars to offer different drink prices at different times throughout the day. To find out how things might change, Casey Current's Suzanne Hogan went bar hopping in Lawrence, not for drinks, just with a microphone.
Downtown Lawrence is cluttered with bars, restaurants, small boutiques, and shops. School is out, it's a hot afternoon, bars are open, but not crazy busy. Inside the Bourgeois Pig, bartender Adam Lott is making mojitos and serving beers. A couple tables and some chairs are full at the cozy bar and coffee spot. Fresh mint fills the room.
I don't see it like becoming like a crazy, like, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah, everyone's drunk at 3 in the afternoon or anything like that, you know? I think the way people's lives are organized these days, that it just won't happen that way.
Now, when the happy hour ban came down on Kansas in 1985, bars responded by offering daily drink specials. Most will still do this.
Mondays, we have $5 horse feathers and $5 Moscow mules on Tuesdays it's, you know, wine night. Wednesdays, fusion night.
So with creative daily specials the norm, does a couple bucks off a beer or a cocktail for just a couple hours really make any difference?
I've lived here since I was 21.
Seth Weiss from the Replay Lounge.
I didn't grow up with happy hours growing up. I don't know if it's going to get more like people that are coming, getting off of work, coming down, get a drink before you go home, or if it's going to bring in a little bit older crowd, or if we're just, you know, have a bunch of bums hanging out. It'd be nice to go someplace and they have a specific beer, like, here, try this for $2, but it's only going on for like 2 hours. It's kind of a good, just a nice little quirk.
My name is Victoria Wren, and I work at the Dynamite Saloon. Students like to go out and, like, socially drink, and I think it'll help. I personally think it'll, like, slow down, like, late-night binge drinking, because I think it'll be, like, an easier progression for someone just, like, you know, 4 to 6 or something. They can go have a couple beers, and it'll be cheaper instead of, you know, dollar night at Fatso's, where it's just easy to get wasted.
And that was part of the idea behind the original ban on happy hour, that cheaper drink prices led to excessive consumption, drunk driving, and now that the law is changing, alcohol safety advocates remind that cheap specials should not be abused. Outside of the tap room is Charlie. He's a bartender there, but off duty and hanging out.
I've never experienced a happy hour, as it were, you know.
He's smoking a cigarette outside of the bar with a handful of tipsy regulars.
It might also make it more hard to manage, you know.
You would have to deal with.
It's terrible. Unruly, like these guys.
One of the unruly patrons flips Charlie the bird.
Where do you go?
There you go.
You want the truth?
They seem fine enough.
They're pretty ruly.
Inside the tap room, Jerome Favor serves up a beer to the ruly regulars. They're playing pool.
Anybody who's budget-minded will probably be an enticement to drink more. For the most part, I think people pretty much drink as much as they want to. So I don't really think it's going to make that big of a difference.
So, for the first time in 27 years, Kansans can raise their glasses and say cheers to the return of the happy hour. Suzanne Hogan, KCUR News.
Thursday, Friday, happy days. Saturday, what a day. Grooving all week with you. These days are ours. Share them with me.
Happy days.
These days are ours.
Happy and free.
These happy days are yours and mine.
These happy days are yours and mine.
Happy days.
This next story, well, let's set it up in rhyme.
Each month, the American Jazz Museum hosts the Jazz Poetry Jams.
Anyone can come and perform in these open mic slams.
The museum, down at 18th and Vine,
allows amateur poets to speak and shine.
The museum has a team of young poets
who work hard and show it.
In July, the team will fly to San Francisco for Brave New Voices, a national competition.
KCUR intern Eric Baker went to the jams and came back with this transmission.
Let's play a word association game. What do you think when I say Kansas City? Barbecue? The Royals? How about jazz? Now what about when I say jazz? What do you think? It probably isn't poetry.
I get hysterical when they tell me that blacks are meant to be miserable, only tolerable when put to sleep. These words are speak, not mine, from the divine, so give me time to get my thoughts together. Guess whether or not you know it, you need a savior, but the only ones to save us is ourselves, and the only trinity is you and me. Have you stopped to think of all the things we could be?
Bobby Jones is performing a poem at the jams in the Blue Room. The room, like his name suggests, has blue walls and flooring. Even the lights in the bar are blue. Jazz memorabilia is all around, and a mural of famous musicians covers one of the walls. By showtime, the place is packed, but still comfortable, with about 150 people of all ages and races. The stage is set with a grand piano, a couple basses, and a drum set, all shining in the mood-setting red and purple lights. The Jazz Poetry Jams are a true blending of Kansas City's established jazz scene and the ever-growing presence of spoken word. Kansas City's abundant, informative history in jazz is reshaping the way Kansas City slam poets are writing. Glenn North is the poet in residence and education manager at the American Jazz Museum. He has also been the MC for the monthly jams for almost 9 years now. North defines spoken word as everyman poetry with an extra edge that's meant to be performed. Some famous poets who have visited include Georgia Mee, Terrence Hayes, and Elizabeth Alexander.
But when they come to Kansas City, they all agree that there's something special happening here in Kansas City. They're surprised at the level of talent that they see in Kansas City, and they're surprised also at the originality. Oftentimes on the coast, there are certain cadences where what happens is a lot of the spoken word sounds the same. But you hear a lot of original voices here in Kansas City, and I think that that's one of the things we can really be proud of.
North says that slam poetry is a competition style of spoken word that got its start in the Green Mill in Chicago in the early 90s. Its originator, Mark Smith, wanted to mix the energy of boxing with the art of poetry. It quickly took off, and a national poetry slam was organized with teams from all over the country. North thinks that slam poetry is a great way to get youth interested in poetry in general.
When a storm drives you to a point of break, keep your foot on the gas and accelerate your wheels through the night and windshield, wipe your tears from your face, your road to redemption is just right up the block. All you have to do is leave this parking lot, and if anyone wants to be Bruce and karate kick you while you're down, tell them you Rip Lee's. Believe it or not.
That was Trane Newman, a Paseo High School graduate, with his poem Scars of Fallen Shadows. Newman is one of the young men on the American Jazz Museum's team headed for the National Slam Competition. Slam poetry may be worldwide at this point, but what sets the jazz poetry jams apart from any other slam is in its name, the jazz. Glenn North even goes so far as to call Kansas City the one-time mecca of jazz. Before the open mic begins, there's a 30-minute jazz concert by the House three-piece band. Poets are even encouraged to ask for improvised musical accompaniment from the band during their poems. But what makes jazz and poetry such a complementary couple? North explains.
There are several things that connect jazz and poetry. One is the musicality of language. Poets are very concerned with exploring like the way words can create music. Oftentimes, listening to jazz music kind of helps you explore that in a more substantive and meaningful way. The other thing is when we're talking about spoken word, just that spirit of improvisation.
Poet Bobby Jones shows a great example of how jazz and poetry can mix to create a new form of slam, an evolution, if you will. This poem was inspired by Jill Scott's song, Slowly, Surely. She asked the band to play something slow and beautiful.
It seems today no one takes the time to love, to flirt and be infatuated with someone. To call a woman beautiful or call a man handsome. What happened to the time when love was special? When was it good wasn't in reference to our conversation, not about our internal gyrations or who came to climaxation. Slowly, surely, I will have it.
Eric Baker, KCUR News.
The next Jazz Poetry Jam is Tuesday evening, July 17th in the Blue Room at the American Jazz Museum.
Thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producers Alex Smith and Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Zach Lewandowski, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.